just I will skip most of the introductory part, as you know, it's going to be 20 minutes talking or so. And this is basically what I will. That's the very short version of my talk. We have two galaxies. Each one has, as we know today, but we assume that even in the past was pretty much the same, has a black hole, galaxy merge. And if we have a merge of galaxies, we expect to have a cosmic population of binary supermassive or massive black holes. I will detail this, the mass range we are talking. And a binary supermassive, a binary made by two supermassive black holes is, of course, a natural source of gravitational radiation. This is the, what I will talk today. It's a project that we started, let's say, 3 years ago with Piero and Alberto Cesano and Marta Volontari. That Marta Volontari now is at UCSC. She's moving to Cambridge, England. And at that time, she worked as a PhD student in Como, where I work. And Alberto Cesano is now a PhD student at Como University. So I will, as I said, skip most of the introductory part. This is the tail of the long version of the talk. We have information about the presence of supermassive black holes in local galaxies. So the question is how they form, how fast they form. We have heard from Piero's talk yesterday that there is an indication that very massive black holes were formed, were already present at ratio of 6 or so. So they must have been formed very rapidly during the evolution. And then I will show our it's a semi-analytical, in a sense, model for following the dynamic and evolution of black holes within the host galaxies. Okay, and the focus of my talk will be the to try to characterize the gravitational wave emission from the cosmic population of black hole binaries that we expect to have naturally in a hierarchical cosmologies, where better than me that we start having small structures forming first, then they evolve into bigger and bigger structures. So we expect to have a sort of hierarchical clustering of dark matter halos, and we expect also to have a sort of hierarchical, if you say, structure of black hole binaries. Okay, the mass of black holes, we know that reflect the mass of the dark matter halo. So we expect to have small, light black holes at high redshift that becomes more and more heavy as the cosmological time proceeds. These are the three papers when all this stuff is detailed, and if you are interested, you can try to read them. Okay, the model we are we need to employ, it's this one. We start from seed pre-galactic black holes. We have some indication, theoretical indication, that the first stars form in the universe as metal-free stars at a ratio of about 30 or so, and there are indications that these stars were probably massive, in the sense where masses exceeding 100 solar masses. And so we expect that this population of first stars that we call POP3 stars end up as black holes with a mass that is, let's say, an order of magnitude larger than the typical galactic black hole candidates that we observe in our galaxy in X-ray binaries. That's the X-ray binaries have black holes with masses around 10 solar masses. Here we are talking about masses between 100 and few hundred solar masses. As the hierarchical clustering goes on, these black holes are incorporated into larger and larger halos, and black holes can grow in mass by two different processes. One is simple, because they merge, and so the mass of the black holes of course increase, but the main the main factor of mass increase is the gas accretion. So we assume again that in the during every major merger between dark matter halos, the we trigger the quasar activities. Even though at very high redshift, we better speak about mini quasars, because they are not 10 to the 6 solar mass objects or 10 to the 7. We are talking still about a few hundred solar mass black holes. But we trigger this quasar activity so the black hole can accrete gas and increase its mass. We have observational constraints, of course, for this kind of scenario. There are the we should be able to reproduce at a low redshift, and low redshift I mean everything below 6, the quasar luminosity function. We should be able to reproduce the mass versus sigma relation that we observe in nearby galaxies. Also, we this model has clear predictions about the presence of wandering black holes. That black holes are not in the center of galaxies but are wandering in the outskirts. And also the presence of a binary black holes can have impact on shaping the core of galaxies by ejecting stars. Okay, so these are a list of observational constraints and prediction that this model can have. We employed a semi-analytical model for the assembly of supermassive black hole. This is a very brief description. We use a binary merger tree starting at a ratio of about 20, and following the hierarchical tree of the main halo that we observe at a ratio of 0. Okay, everything is made in the Lambda CDM cosmology with usual parameters, and we start a ratio of 20. Placing black hole with a mass of 150 solar mass in 3.5 sigma fluctuations. We run models with different choices, and the results are not very sensitive on these assumptions here. Let's see what's next. Okay, as I said, the black hole mass can grow along the cosmic history because of mergers and because of accretion. It has been realized that if the black holes were placed into ray or sigma peaks, merger alone is not sufficient to account for the mass density of black holes that we observe today. So the main contribution to the final black hole mass that we observe today must come from accretion. Okay, so we have here a list of assumptions that we made in our models. All of these assumptions are based on scientific motivations. The first one is that we let the black hole to accrete only during major mergers. And we define major mergers as merger when the mass ratio between the satellite and the main halo is larger than 0.3. Okay? That's the first assumption. The second assumption is a strong assumption. Again, it's based on some physical arguments that during the major merger, the most massive black hole is going to accrete a mass that scales with the let's say roughly the fifth power of the velocity dispersion. This is what you see in the mass versus sigma relation. And the other assumption is that the accretion rate every time we have a major merger.
So what sigma is that?
It's the stellar velocity dispersion that we link to the using the Ferrarese link to the halo circular velocity. And also we assume that the black holes accrete at the Eddington rate. Okay. And okay, it's quite obvious with this kind of assumptions that the final mass of the black holes is largely dominated by the accreted gas rather than by the accumulated mass because of the merger. Okay, so the final mass of our cosmic population of black holes is built up by accretion, not by the first seed black holes that we put at the redshift of 20. Okay, so galaxy merge. The galaxies host massive black holes, so we have a large population of massive black hole barons. There are four. And we try to follow the dynamical evolution of black hole pairs using simple recipes. Okay, the dynamical evolution of black hole pairs, many of you were last week at the talk by Miloš Milojazević that gave a very detailed talk about the dynamical evolution of black hole pairs. So here I'm just repeating a few things. The dynamic evolution of black hole pairs can be divided into three main steps. The first step is the dynamical friction phase, where the two dark matter halos are merging. And the important thing is that the dynamical friction time scale scales is inversely proportional to the mass ratio of the two halos. So if the two halos have very different mass, the dynamical friction time scale can be longer than the Hubble time. So basically what happens is that if we are merging two dark matter halos that are very different in mass, we don't expect that the lighter black hole falls into the center of the new formed halo very efficiently. So we have we expect a population of so-called wandering black holes that are still on their way to the center of the main halo. The second stage is when we have the two black holes. If the two black holes can be taken from the dynamical friction phase enough close to form a binary system, we have the hardening phase. In the hardening phase, the binary can shrink because by ejecting background stars. Basically, the stars are removing binding energy from the binary and getting kinetic energy that are ejected at very high velocity. And this is the hardening of the binary phase. The trouble here is that as the binary as the two black holes get closer and closer to each other, the density of stars decreases, so this process tends to become less and less efficient as the binary shrinks down. And the third part is, of course, if the two black holes can reach a separation that is of the order of milliparsec, we can have a very efficient emission of gravitational waves that cause the final coalescence of the two black holes. In this plot, I show that's the time in giga year as a function of redshift average for all our realizations. So here we have different masses of black holes, and the purple points are the time, the sum of the hardening time and the gravitational radiation time scale, and the black is the dynamical friction time scale. A very high redshift, the dynamics is basically ruled by the hardening time scale, while a low redshift, the two time scales, this one and that one, became comparable. The important thing here is that in our model, the vast majority of black holes can coalesce within a Hubble time. So we have a large source of gravitational waves. Okay. I will skip this. There are other, let's say, second order effects that can complicate the dynamics. For example, triple black hole interactions can eject binaries and black holes from the center of galaxies. Another important thing that one have to care is the fact that the center of mass of the binary is going to move when the two black holes coalesce, because there is not a symmetry. There is a symmetry only if the two black holes are equal mass and are not rotating. And all these kind of facts can be and must be taken into account. And this is just to show you that our model, this is the mass, the accumulated mass in black holes that are in the center of galaxies as a function of redshift, compared to the red line is the integral of the quasar luminosity functions in the B band with some correction, bolometric corrections, assuming an efficiency of 10% of conversion of mass into energy. And we are able to reproduce basically the observational constraints given by the quasi-luminosity function. Of course, with some assumption concerning the efficiency. Okay, so for what concerns the gravitational wave emission, the important quantity is the coalescence rate as a function of redshift. Here I show the number of coalescence per unit redshift, per unit observer time, per unit observer year, actually, in our calculation. Our models is the solid line. We have here plotted other two, test models, but they are just details. In our models, we have a number that is about 60 coalescences per year, per observer year, and this is the same with the cut in mass. Okay, here we are considering only binaries that are more mass, less mass than 10 to the fifth solar masses. And you see that most of our coalescences are at quite high redshift, about 10, so involve light black holes. Okay, we have just a bunch of coalescences at a low redshift involving real supermassive black holes. Okay, and if we cut in a mass range between 10 to 7, 10 to 9 solar masses, that is where Cepheid galaxies and quasars are, we see that we expect to have less than one coalescence per observed year.
Does this depend a lot on the seed mass you took, or is
it No. It does not. We tested. We tried different seed masses, started from 100 to 1,000 solar masses. If we stay in a sensible range, these numbers do not change much. Okay, so we have coalescence rate, so we have gravitational waves. Okay, this is the very naive way in which I can show the essence of computed gravitational waves from binary black holes. Everything is in is textbook, pretty tough to understand, but nothing new. The basic point is that you can compute a gravitational wave emission in a so-called linearized theory, in which you write the metric as a small perturbation of the Minkowski metric. So you work in a flat spacetime, and you have just a little wiggle on the spacetime that are caused by the gravitational waves. What you can find is that the gravitational wave is at the end of your back on the envelope, let's say several envelopes calculation, the metric is as this form. This is the metric of a gravitational wave that is propagating along the x-axis. So it has just component into the y and z axis. So it's a transverse wave, okay, with two different polarization state, the cross and the plus polarization state. Okay, and this plot that I grabbed from a paper by Bernard Schultz show you what happens if you have a ring of masses placed here and the gravitational waves is going in that direction. Okay, so when the h, that is the small perturbation to the Minkowski metric, is zero, the ring is a ring, but it's perturbed in this direction, in that direction. This is the plus polarization, or 45 degrees angle in that direction. This is the cross polarization. Okay. The other important thing, that if you put units, the luminosity of gravitational waves is very small. Okay. Here you have a g divided by c 5, so it's a small number. So it's hard to detect gravitational waves. How to detect gravitational waves? Okay, the problem with supermassive black holes, if you take two supermassive black holes, 10 to the 6 solar masses, you work out what is the frequency of gravitational wave that you expect. You sort out that at the last stable orbit is of the order of 10 to the minus 2 Earths. Okay, it's of the order of the orbital period. It's two times the orbital period, the orbital frequency. And so if you want to detect a gravitational wave with a frequency of 10 to the minus 2 Earths, you have to take a Michelson interferometer and make very, very long. So this is what this is the basic concept of LISA. LISA is basically a huge Michelson interferometer put in space, okay? And as the arm length is 5 million kilometers, and this is how it is on the Earth orbit, okay? And this shows you the where LISA is going to work compared to LIGO. LIGO is work at frequency of 100 Hertz, so it's calibrated for detecting gravitational waves from small binaries. I mean, light binaries like galactic black hole binaries, galactic in the sense of galactic mass, 10 solar mass black hole binaries. While LISA works, its efficiency is larger, it's largest at 10 to the minus 2 Hertz, around 10 to the minus 2 Hertz, and it's sweeter for getting the signal from massive black hole binaries, okay? And this is, I think, it's an amazing stuff. Okay, so this is the our first plot, our first result is the gravitational wave background that we expect if we integrate all our cosmic population of black holes, okay? And what you have to look is the black line. This plot spans some 14 orders of magnitude in frequency, and here what I plot is the strain square, that is the strain is the perturbation to the Minkowski metric. You have to compare this number to one if you wish. So this is the percentual perturbation to the Minkowski metric. And here we can see three different regimes. This is the so-called classical gravitational wave losses. If you have a binary that is losing energy because of gravitational wave emission, you will have this sort of spectrum that goes like the frequency to the minus 2 third. Then we have other two regimes. This regime here that is steeper here, it's the convolution of all the binaries catching the last stable orbit, okay? So this slope here is dictated by general relativity. This slope here is dictated by the cosmic population, I mean the cosmic properties of our population, how many black holes we have at each redshift, okay? And then we have another at very, very low frequency regime in which the binary is losing energy not because of gravitational wave emission but because of ejecting stars. Okay, so here the losses of the binary are due to slingshot, and so we have this spectrum. The question we have to answer is this a stochastic background or can be resolved into discrete sources? This is a very important question. The blue line here is the expected noise, instrumental noise from LISA. Okay, the blue line here, and here we are. We have other two noises of other two sources of noises. The red line is the extragalactic white dwarf binary noises from unresolved sources computed by Farmer and Finney, and the purple line is the unresolved galactic white dwarf noises. Okay, if the noises are real noises, they should be summed up to the instrumental noise. So we have to know if this, our black line, is really a stochastic background or can be resolved into discrete sources. To do that, what we have to do is simply to count how many sources we have per frequency resolution beam. Frequency resolution beam is basically the inverse of the observation time. If we have a three-year integration of a LISA mission, the frequency resolution beam is 10 to the minus 8 Hertz. So when we count how many sources we have per beam, these are the results. This is for a signal to noise of 1, signal to noise of 5. What we have is that we have always less than one source per frequency resolution beam. So this means that our background is not a background, is not a stochastic background, but can be resolved into single source. This is another way of looking at this. This is the instrumental noise of LISA. This is due to galactic white dwarfs binary. This is due to extragalactic white dwarf binaries. So the overall noise, stochastic noise, is the black line. And this is the residual confusion noise due to massive black hole binaries. So this is the level in which we start of having more than one source per frequency resolution beam. And you see that, of course, it dominates over lighter binaries, over white dwarf at low frequencies, but it's always an order of magnitude lower than instrumental noise. So the point here is that massive black hole binaries are not a source of confusion noise for LISA. Okay, they can be resolved into single events. Okay, so now we want, the last thing that I want to do is just to characterize the signal of LISA that we expect to have from massive black hole binaries. Yes?
By resolve, you mean like resolve in frequency space?
Yeah.
So does it have any kind of spatial location?
Well, LISA, it's an all-sky monitor in the sense that it takes everything coming from the sky. You can, if you resolve a source, you can have a spatial resolution that depends a lot on the polarization of the wave, on the inclination with respect to the, and could be as, I don't know, that the lower limit.
The resolution will be for these sources typically about a degree or a little bit better.
And this is because of the, if they last long enough, it's because of the orbit?
Right, indeed, yeah. Yeah, so it's just the modulation of the signal due to the orbit.
But your expectation is that the signal is going to be in a quarter of magnitude lower than the noise level?
The unresolved signal.
Yeah.
That's the unresolved signal. What I was saying that the unresolved signal is going to be one order of magnitude below the instrumental noise. So it's not an issue. What I would like to know now is the resolved ones. What kind of signal we expect to see. So for a single source, the important thing is the strain. This H here, as I show you, is the, if you wish, you have to compare this number with one, that is the perturbation to the flat spacetime. And that's the so-called strain, depends on this is the chirp mass that is has the dimension of a mass, but it's actually a combination of the mass of the two holes. This is the distance of the source, and this is how it scales with the frequency. Okay. A binary, when it's orbiting, is a sort of quasi-periodical oscillator, in the sense that it's at each orbit emits a fixed frequency, but it shifts as the binary shrinks. Okay, so we have a periodic signal that is shifting in time as the binary shrinks. So the important quantity is the so-called characteristic strain, that is the strain times the number of cycles that a binary spends in a given frequency range. Okay. So this is what actually is observed by an interferometer. And if you work out the numbers, you find that the characteristic strain scales like a frequency to a minus 1/6. Okay? This is when the number of cycles in a given frequency range is, when the orbital period is shorter than the observational time. Okay. The other important thing is the signal to noise. Once that you have the characteristic strain of a source, you have to integrate the signal to noise all over your observation. So this is the characteristic strains at a given frequency. This is the instrumental noise plus unresolved binaries and all this stuff as a function of frequency. And you integrate along your observation. This delta F is the frequency range that the binary spans within an observation time that we assume to be 3 years. Okay, so this builds up the final signal to noise of your binary. You have to integrate over 3 years of observation. Okay, this is how the strain appears for different black holes binary. Green is a black hole with a mass, the larger black hole has a mass of 10 to the 7 solar masses, and the smallest is 10 to the 6, this 10 to the 6, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 4. And these three lines are binaries placed at redshift of 1, 3, and 5, okay? And so this is how they appear into the in this strain frequency plot. And you see that all these black holes are very well observable by LISA. The strain is well above the sensitivity threshold. Okay? The point here are the places where you are 1 month, 1 week, and 1 day before coalescence, just to give you an idea. The purple line here is a different, in a sense, kind of binaries. There are, this is equal mass binary, 1,000 solar mass, a ratio of 7. What you observe here is that the final coalescence is well below the LISA sensitivity threshold. Nevertheless, if you integrate the signal-to-noise of this observation along the binary along the observation, the signal-to-noise is larger than here we are assuming 5. So this can be detected, but you cannot actually see the final coalescence stage. Okay. So we have so-called, these are co-stationary binary. There are binaries in this regime here that basically during 3 years they emit at a given fixed frequency because evolution is very, they are large separation binary. Then we have the merging binary and then so-called in spiral binary. They are binary that we actually see in spiraling, but we cannot observe the final coalescence. Okay, and you see these binary are light, these binary are more massive. If you think about how our hierarchical model, these binaries are at high redshift, these binaries are at low redshift because they are more massive. So we have just a few plots left. Okay, this is the total number of events that we expect to observe in 10 to the 8 seconds, that is 3 years. The total number is about 100. Resolved events with the signal to noise larger than 5, we assume a threshold of 5 for the signal to noise. And as I said, we have two different populations. These are the merging events, the red line, that is the events where you can actually observe above signal-to-noise of 5 the coalescence phase. So they are particularly important because you can really test GR in strong conditions there. And you see that the number of these events has a peak of a ratio about 3 and 5. While the in-spiral events are at a much higher redshift, peak at about 7 or 8, with a tail that can reach redshift as large as 12 or so. Okay? In total, these are about 40 and these are 60. That's the mass function of our events. That's the mass of the heavy element of the binary. Again, merging events as that are events when you observe the coalescence has a mass in the range 10 to the 4, 10 to the 7. Okay? While in spiral events, they are high redshift events, have a much lighter mass function that is peaked between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 4 solar mass. That's the heavy member of the binary. This is the mass ratio of the binaries that we observe. Okay, so that's the log of the lighter divided by the heaviest. And you see that again, the in-spiral events, the high ratio events, have a mass ratio that is of the order of 1, okay, because the population of black holes is not evolved much, so they have similar masses, while the merging events has a mass ratio that is of the order of 0.1. Okay. And this is the last plot I would like to show. This is the what I dubbed here the detection efficiency. What I've done is I get all the coalescences that we have in theory, and I plot the duration between all the coalescences divided by the detectable events, okay, as a function of redshift. So what does it mean is that if you count all the coalescences between redshift 0 and 1, you actually observe 100% of your population of coalescing black holes. Okay? At ratio of 5, you're still observing roughly 90% of all coalescences. Okay? So the efficiency drop below 50% of the ratio is about 7. This would mean that LISA will be very powerful in mapping the coalescing population of black holes, because we have an efficiency that is larger than 50% for all episodes occurring at a redshift lower than 8, roughly. So we are not missing a lot of stuff. Oh, okay. This is if I calculate merging events and in spiral events. This is just for the merging events, where I can observe the coalescence phase. Okay, so that's the summary. Seed black hole from first star in high sigma peaks. The mass accretion is triggered by major merger. And we have black hole interactions, slingshots, and rocket effects of this kind of thing. We have seen that the accretion, if we allow the black hole to accrete at the Eddington limit during major merger, we can recover. Well, actually, I didn't show it. the mass versus sigma relation, we can also recover the quasi-luminosity function. And we have important dynamic and gravitational interaction between the black holes that can displace the black hole from the center, giving rise to a population of Wandon black holes that I didn't talk much about it. And these are the results for what concerns the gravitational waves. We have about 35 merging binaries. That's binaries where we can observe the coalescence phase in a ratio between 1 and 7. And 65 in spiral binaries, that's binaries that are above signal tolerance of 5, but we cannot observe the final coalescence phase because they are too high frequency for LISA. That's in the range 4 and 12. And we do not expect to see any stationary events because these are events that are basically emitted at a fixed frequency. Okay, we expect not to see any of them. So that's it. Okay. I'm done.